TFM.
This is J.G. Hertz, the General Martok on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine podcast. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he always is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. And Matthew, I just have one question for you before we start. Do you need a new suit?
You know, Chris, it's funny you mentioned that. I was actually just thinking about that today, and, you know, maybe I should come around hour 2057, you know, maybe check out some of your new offerings.
Yeah, that might be a little bit too late. I think I want you to buy a new suit tonight at 2055 exactly.
Ah, okay. No, you know what? That actually works a little bit better for me. Those 2 minutes are going to make all the difference.
Well, they really are. And you just wait and see. Yes, everyone, we are continuing our 30th anniversary rewatch of Deep Space Nine here on The Orb. And today we're going to be talking about past prologue. Here is a quick rundown of the story. As the Federation begins to settle into its presence aboard the former Cardassian station, now dubbed Deep Space Nine, the arrival of a former Bajoran freedom fighter named Tana Los puts Major Kira in the uncomfortable situation of protecting an old friend and supporting the new alliance between Bajor and the Federation. When she learns that Tana has not given up his terrorist ways, she must choose between her past and future. Either way, she says, she must betray someone. Or, Matthew, as Netflix describes this episode, Dr. Bashir is excited to meet Garak, the last Cardassian aboard Deep Space Nine and a rumored spy. That's the whole description on Netflix. So I think although that is a great part of the story, I think they kind of missed the point of this episode, as we'll discuss it today, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because as you come into this from the pilot, it is fascinating to see just how much kind of gets introduced and then really builds off of the first episode. And I think one of the things that you get picked up there with Netflix is that we meet Garak. And Garak becomes such an incredibly important part of Deep Space Nine. And I think most people think of him as having more episodes than he does. And part of that, I think, is that you were introduced to him so early. I mean, this is the second episode. And it creates this wonderful ability then to be able to kind of expound and kind of help us learn a lot about who Bashir actually is, which is this very overeager, you know, I mean, he just seems like he's going to jump out of his skin at any moment because he's just so excited about everything. And yet he's also somebody who is 100% completely green.
Yeah.
Right. You know, he has no idea of the subtleties of what's happening here. He sees everything on the surface, which is such an amazing place for this character then to be able to grow. Right. By the time we end the series, the character is going to look nothing like he does now. And that has nothing to do with like physically, just like the character makeup is going to be so different.
Yeah.
And Garak is a big part of Bashir growing in that process. And then, of course, you know, Garak himself becomes such an interesting character. So I just I love that this is the first part of this episode here of, you know, Bashir meeting Garak, and it's a wonderful meeting. It's such a strange meeting mm-hmm. as well. Just the, and Garak himself is, and I think the way Robinson plays him is quite alien. It's very different. You know, it has this kind of unsettling feeling to it. So, I mean, all of that is just so great that that's happening here in this first episode.
Yeah, absolutely. And before I share thoughts on that, I did want to point out, because some people listening might be wondering, why are you talking about past prologue? I thought A Man Alone was the second episode. And this is when we were in that age of Star Trek where it was common that they would, it's fairly common that they would produce episodes but air them in a different order than they produced them. And most of the time it doesn't really matter too much, like on TNG or TOS, didn't matter. Here, because it's the very beginning of the series, it's maybe a little bit odd. So A Man Alone was the second produced episode and Past Prologue was the third produced, but they aired in the other order, and they aired with Past Prologue on January 9th, which was 6 days after Emissary, and then a week later A Man Alone came out. So I just wanted to point that out at the beginning, that we're going to be doing these in the order they air, because there are a few others like this. But related to that, something you said, Matthew, was interesting about how this picks up from Emissary and you feel like a lot of stuff has happened. And really, this is the one where I feel like airing this one second was the right choice, personally. And the main thing that I see that stands out to me a little bit here with that airing order is just some comments that Odo makes, because A Man Alone, we get more character background about Odo. And then he makes some comments in here that make a lot more sense once you've been introduced to kind of his sense of justice and his role and so forth. So that's a little note about the order we're going to go in throughout this rewatch. But as far as Garak goes, like you said, the way Andy Robinson plays Garak here in his very first appearance, when I was rewatching it for this discussion, which is probably the 100th time I've seen this episode, it really stood out to me here how well he seemed to understand that character from the moment he walked on the screen. You know, you talk about Bashir and how green he is and how his character will evolve, but Garak in this episode is just plain Garak that we know. And already from the start, you get that feeling he has so much inside information. He knows how to kind of manipulate people. And he also shows us that while, yes, he is a leftover from the past, he's a Cardassian still aboard the station, and we don't know his background yet in terms of how he's involved in intelligence or anything, but we can see that he's really aware of what's going on around him and willing to help the Federation and help the Bajorans here, because it's really thanks to him that they're able to prevent at least the deaths of Bajorans on Bajor 8 on those colonies.
Yeah, I think one of the things is, as you were talking, I was thinking how Alexander Siddig plays Bashir as a person who is completely uncomfortable in his own skin because of everything that's so new for him here, whereas Andy Robinson comes on the screen and he just feels so confident and comfortable with who he is and exudes that as if, you know, Garak is a character who has existed longer, who has lived longer, who has way more experience, who is you know, cultured and has nuance and all of these things that Bashir completely lacks. And like you said, does that immediately. Like, you know, it feels as if he has been playing this character for years and years, or if he just is this character. And I think that's one of the things that, you know, makes Garak such a standout here. I mean, again, second episode that's aired, and you get this character, and we know he's going to be recurring. You know, you don't know that coming in to this episode when you're watching it for the first time.
Yeah, right. You don't know, even at the end of this episode, you don't know that he's going to become part of the story, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and so I think the beauty of that, though, is that you would see, they would see this on screen and feel like, okay, no, this is going to be something we're going to have to continue with. We're going to have this character back because of the relationship you automatically get there with Bashir, which, again, those two things become this running tagline throughout the series as their relationship grows. And again, this relationship allows you to build two characters simultaneously. Mm-hmm. And not any disrespect to Garak, but more importantly, this relationship is what helps build our main character mm-hmm. on the show, who is, you know, a part of the main cast. It gives him, as we move forward, that depth. It gives him that different understanding of life. And in many ways, I think Garak gives Bashir his kind of cynicalness that you get later on. Mm-hmm. Or I would say maybe pragmatism, to put it in a better way. Mm-hmm. But that's the joy of seeing this now, as anybody who's watched the show, we know what's coming. But to get that introduction here, and again, Andy Robinson portraying the character just practically perfect in every way. He's like the Mary Poppins of DS9 mm-hmm. at this point. It's just this really incredible, I would say, lightning struck, you know, with this episode in that way. And so, I was just kind of blown away watching this episode just to see just how perfectly everything worked on that front. So.
Yeah. And on the Bashir side, the interactions that Bashir and Garak have there at the beginning, Bashir is so uncomfortable by this situation because, again, I guess he's heard, right, that maybe Garak is a spy, and he's kind of curious and suspicious, but maybe a little bit scared because he's out here in the wilderness now and this is happening to him. But when he goes back to Ops, he's so excited to tell everyone about the fact that Garak came up to him, the spy. And Miles is looking at him kind of like, okay, you know, I can tell you are out here for the first time. And maybe colored a little bit by Miles's feelings about Cardassians as well. But just the way he rushes back and he's so excited. And it's a great element to the story that works really well for the plot of this episode and being able to resolve it at the end. So I love that we get this relationship kicked off right at the start of the series. We don't have to wait. It's right here now.
Well, and I think the interesting thing here is that Bashir comes off as somebody who's read a lot of spy novels.
Yeah, right.
But has no ability to comprehend and or deal with the situation with mm-hmm. any kind of reserve. Mm-hmm. And again, he just has so little self-awareness at this point, and he is completely green. And mm-hmm. that's something that's going to 100% change by the time we get to the end of the show.
Yeah.
And I know many people were not a fan of the character from the beginning, but I think the beauty of Deep Space Nine is for every character gets the opportunity to go from one place to another mm-hmm. and have a really interesting arc play out for them. And mm-hmm. Bashir has one of the most interesting because in many ways, he's one of the characters that does change the most by the end of the series.
Yeah, definitely. Well, let's talk about the core of the story, which I've called The Struggle Continues on our outline. But this is the whole situation of Tanalos coming aboard. We find out that there's this splinter group called the Konma, which are like a terrorist organization that's continuing the fight against the Cardassians, even after they've withdrawn, which is, of course, making it difficult for the provisional government. And it will also cause problems for the Federation to try to assist them if that goes on, because then the Federation has to be this stand between the Cardassians and the Bajorans in a way that obviously they don't want to have to be put into that situation. And the key to it all, though, is of course that Kira knows Tana. And as we learn, as the story unfolds, Tana knew Kira was there and they came there expecting that she's going to be able to help them in their plan to collapse the wormhole. And we're seeing at the beginning of this episode, very beginning of this episode, and towards the end of Emissary, we see Kira trying to ease in. She's moving forward in her new role as the liaison officer to the Federation. And then right away, she's put into the situation where she has to choose between her past and her future. And it's clearly not easy to let go.
Yeah, I think this might be one of the best things that this episode does, aside from obviously with what we're talking about with Bashir and Garrick, but the reality of the situation of where Bajor had been for the last 50 years with the Cardassians, and this episode just right up front shows you how different is this series is going to be from TNG. We talked about that in our last episode, but this one does as well, in the sense that instead of making this an easy journey for Bajor to become part of the Federation, this situation that's happened for the last 50 years with these two rival peoples is not going to be easily overcome. It's going to be overcome in the same way that we in our own world have seen struggles like this throughout history, where major conflicts end, but then there's one group who just can't let it go. Mm-hmm. And part of that has to do with them getting so used to the fighting, getting used to the killing, maybe even enjoying the killing. And that, what we're doing is we're adding true narrative depth to the storyline here, and not creating cookie cutter characters or alien races, but we're adding depth that feels so real to our experience as human beings on this planet, and it makes us be able to relate to these characters. You know, if you can't put yourself in the position of Ta'ana Los and the Khon Maw, then I think you have a very inactive imagination to be able to put yourself in a place where you could see yourself wanting to do that. I think everybody can kind of get themselves to that place. The same way that we can kind of get ourselves to the place that Kira is in, right? Where it's like, so I think the beauty of this episode is that it doesn't make any of these decisions easy.
Yeah. I would say not necessarily getting yourself to a place where you want to kill other people, but where you're fighting for something that you believe in, and you can't let go once there has been some sort of resolution that you don't agree with.
Right. No, I mean, and I even just politically that happens, right? I mean, across our world, we've seen that. It doesn't even have to go all the way to the point of wanting to murder people, but I mean, you know, you can see that happening politically, and so that makes this episode, I think, even more relevant today than it maybe was when it came out, which will say a lot as we watch Deep Space Nine.
Yeah.
But I think the beauty here is the complexity that we're dealing with of the situation, and that it is not black and white, that it isn't so easy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the struggle that we get here with Kira having to realize that fighting now looks different, that the Cardassians are gone. The old way, she says, don't work anymore. And that's because that part of the fight is over, but there is a new part of the fight. The rules and the engagement and the battlefield just looks different, right? It's a political battlefield. It's a political battlefield. Mm-hmm. And so I think I really appreciate that about this series, is that we get shown we're going to continue to dive in deep to these subjects, and we're not going to make it easy for our characters either. There's never an easy button on Deep Space Nine.
Right.
You know?
Right. There's no easy button, and there's no office depot on the promenade.
No, which is kind of weird. You know, don't you need office supplies there? Or I guess, you know,
I guess
really.
When you
just
need
a new pad.
You can just replicate your binders and staplers and all, you don't need the Office Depot anymore.
But that's my stapler there. And
I just watched that movie like 3 nights ago for the first time in Office Space, for the first time in like, I don't know, 10 years probably.
Oh, that's greatness.
Oh, and Stephen Root is so good. And okay.
He's so good.
Let's just take a little detour real quick with Stephen Root in there. I'm a huge News Radio fan. There's an episode of News Radio where Jimmy James is shooting a documentary. And when the camera rolls, he starts speaking like this. He cannot act normal. And when I rewatched Office Space, that is the character, yep. Right? Speaking the same way.
It's so great.
It's really great. But back to what we're talking about here. You know, Kira says that it was so much easier when I knew who the enemy was, or I thought I knew who the enemy was. And that's kind of the key thing that I love about this story is that in Star Trek up to this point, it would have been pretty straightforward because where Kira is at the beginning and in her early interactions with Tana here, she has moved on and realizes that the type of fighting that they were doing in the past isn't where they need to be going now. Of course, they need to, there are things that still need to be solved, but they can't do it in the same way they did before. Mm-hmm. But later...
Well, because, before they were freedom fighters,
right.
Bajor, and even the reality of the type of fighting that was mm-hmm. needed there is something that haunts Kira even to this day, she says, when she's talking to Odo, which I really appreciate. You know, again, none of these things are easy. None of these things don't leave a mark, you know, and I think that's the thing about Deep Space Nine is that the situations that characters are in always leave a mark.
Yeah.
And those marks begin to then add up to the character development that we get through the entire series. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I think, again, we're just differentiating ourselves mm-hmm. immediately here from TNG in that way.
Yeah. And that's real life, right?
Yes, 100%.
Later in the episode, when she's talking to Odo, and there's the whole debate about the runabout and all this stuff, she tells Odo, maybe there are still wars to be fought, and I'm just making a fool of myself doing what I'm mm-hmm. doing here. So as a result of all these interactions with Tana, she's beginning to question where she was at the beginning of the episode and thinking that maybe the approach of the Kama isn't quite as unreasonable as some people might think. And then Odo tells her, it sounds like you're trying to talk yourself into something or out of something. And that leads to the idea of, would she be turning against her own people if she doesn't help Tana? And Odo asks her, are they really your own people? She says, they're no different than I used to be. And Odo says, used to be. And that's the key to the whole story, right? That we have to evolve and change and use our experiences to become different people and better people over time. And mm-hmm. and if we have an ultimate goal, maybe we've followed one path towards achieving that goal and then we've reached a turning point and then something else is needed. And that's what Kira was recognizing. Right. Tana doesn't. The fact that this story throws Kira into a situation where she's questioning her own beliefs is something that, again, I think we didn't see so much in Star Trek up to this point, because normally it would have been presented as more of a clear-cut path, mm-hmm. like, that's the wrong way, this is the right way you should follow. And so right off the bat, like you said, DS9 is differentiating itself here.
Well, there's the nuance that different types of war require different types of battlefields. Mm-hmm. And that's the crux of the issue, is Kira is learning that she is on a different, they, all of Bajor now is on a different type of battlefield.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't keep treating it as if it was the previous battlefield, because it's not the same war anymore. And that's a really important issue. And I think it's, again, it's the genius of this episode coming off that first episode where we set up Bajor. We had that set up from TNG, but we set it up even more. We've already set up the fact that, you know, Bajor is struggling to find its identity now. And this is part of its identity. Kira is a microcosm of the macrocosm of the Bajoran people right now, which is that struggle for identity. And what are they going to look like now that the Cardassians are no longer the same type of enemy that they used to be? And what now are the battles that are worth fighting? And what do those battlefields look like compared to our previous battlefields? And so it's a really well done and well structured episode to come off that first episode to help accentuate what we had already started to set up in the first.
Mm. They could have paid homage to the original series here and called this episode "Let That Be Your Next Battlefield."
There's your next battlefield.
What if in DS9 there was a scene where Kira screams something at the view screen like that in every episode? If wishes were horses, there's your horses.
There's your terrorist.
All right.
Oh,
I guess we don't need a big discussion about this, but just as we're talking about freedom fighters and terrorists, this is one thing that stands out about DS9 being made in 1993, written in, you know, 92, these stories versus today and even late years ago, but later than when the series ended. And I think Nana Visitor actually has mentioned this before in interviews, that she's not sure that the Bajorans and Kira could be portrayed in this way if the series were done now, because of the different distinction, I guess, between freedom fighters and terrorists in today's world. This story does reflect a different time in our world and how we viewed those things.
Yeah, I do think that this really actually deals with the nuance so well, though, because I think it doesn't just clear cut and across the board say that everything that the Bajorans did was fine. In fact, Sisko even mentions that idea, you know, later when he talks about, you know, the fact that there were atrocities on both sides. That's what happens in war.
Right.
And, you know, I think that that's something that, again, is so well done. And it's 100% true. What they're saying in this episode actually comports with reality of war. And, you know, so I really appreciate that. I think they've done just an excellent job in this series, even with this second episode, to help us see that it's not an easy discussion.
And no, it's not.
We can't pretend like it is. And that's the beauty of Deep Space Nine here, is it never pretends like this is easy.
Right. Yeah, I think DS9 does this really well and could still tell the same story, you know, after the 9/11 attacks and beyond, if people are receptive to it. I think that the difficulty is that a lot of people don't look at it from that multi-angle way and just quickly shut it down because of the idea of terrorism is where probably that discussion and those comments come from sometimes. But anyway, just a thing to point out here, because we're dealing actually in this episode with both sides of that, with the Kon Mar versus the Bajoran resistance of the past.
Mm-hmm.
One other thing about Kira I wanted to talk about just briefly is when she doesn't get what she wants from Sisko, She calls Admiral Rollman at Starfleet and interrupts a staff meeting to complain about Sisko.
Yeah.
And I just found that moment interesting in what it says about Kira's view of the Federation at this point, the respect or lack of respect that she has for Sisko and for the Federation being there. And then also how Sisko addresses it later in passing at just the right moment and in a way where he just calls her out for it. And really, she realizes that, maybe I shouldn't have done that. And I think that overall, it really sets the tone for their relationship, Sisko-Kira relationship, to evolve in a positive way over time.
Yeah, this was something that I think was really... it's a smaller part of the episode, but it's a very important part for those two characters, like you mentioned, and their relationship. And, you know, I think it does, you know, one of the struggles that Kira has is her acceptance of the fact that they do need the Federation right now. They need help, which, you know, anybody asking for help, it's not easy. And so that's one of the struggles she faces right now with herself. But And what I thought was so beautiful about the way this episode handles this is that we actually see just how good Sisko actually is at his job here already.
Mm-hmm.
He handles all of these parties perfectly. And it was also really beautiful to see the way in which O'Brien and Dax are already working so well in concert with Sisko that they don't even ask about the situation of keeping the Cardassian ship from being able to dock quickly.
Yeah.
They already know what they need to do in that situation. But I was just really struck by the way that Sisko handles the Cardassians in this episode and the way that he handles Kira in this episode, because he does it with such a deft hand. Mm-hmm. And he never gets upset as if somebody's going over his head or is treating him badly or any of those type of things. But he does it in a way that allows him to let everybody know who's boss. Like, who's the boss? Mm-hmm. It's Sisko. It's not even a question. And I think Kira actually ends up responding to the fact that the way that Sisko handles all these situations, she realizes he actually is on her side.
Right.
But he's on her side who she is now. Just right. Like Oda was talking about, yeah. Not who she used to be.
Yeah.
And I think she responds to his strength, which is, cross me again and you won't be here again. Mm-hmm. I think she respects that. And so All in all, I mean, I'm so blown away by the writing in this episode and how well it's done to cement a relationship that is going to only continue to grow. And the way they do that is at the end of the episode, Sisko doesn't say anything to Kira. He just gives her a knowing look. She gives him one back, and they don't say anything as they walk down the hall.
Mm-hmm.
It's an incredibly played episode by those two actors already at this point.
Yeah.
And it said so much without saying anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's a good point that Sisko is on her side of who she is now, not who she was before. And that's where Sisko and Odo both can see the situation where Kira gets lost in the situation and they both help her, you know, find her way out of it. So one other thing to talk about here is the attempt right at the beginning of the series to attract TNG fans by bringing in familiar faces. Now, I've seen it mentioned by the producers before as efforts to connect DS9 with the wider Star Trek universe, which I think is true, but I think that sounds a bit better when we think about those comments today with the much bigger Star Trek universe than we had in 1993. Here, I feel like it is more of just trying to connect DS9 to TNG by bringing in familiar faces. And at this point in time, Lursa and Bator and the House of Duras and all had been an important storyline on TNG. So it's something that we were very familiar with as viewers. And seeing them appear, I remember watching it the first time was like, oh, Lursa and Bator are here. And I probably received it better in the first viewing because of the context, which makes sense because that is how it was intended, than I do when I look back at it now. And I sometimes feel like I wish DS9 had just stood completely on its own from the beginning instead of bringing in some familiar characters at the beginning of season one like they did. But anyway, I think here they did a good job of bringing in these two familiar characters, but making it important for the story so that it wasn't a cameo situation. It didn't really feel like it was wedged in there just to make the connection. It felt like they were integral to the story.
Yeah, I could not agree more with you. I was thinking to myself how this was a really smart connection to the larger Star Trek universe. And, you know, when you think of where they had been, you know, Sisko even mentions the idea, you know, that the Duras family had tried to take over the Klingon Empire a couple years ago, and it kind of ruined them and their reputation. It obviously would have ruined them and their family fortune. So them doing these type of things for money makes complete sense. It also, you know, plays into the idea you'll actually see this same deal in Star Trek Generations, right? They become basically these almost mercenaries for hire. And I thought that it really played well. And part of that is the thing about Deep Space Nine is people can come and go on from this station because it is a stationary point. And so to have these familiar faces like this show up makes sense. But like you said, the beauty of this is it legitimately plays into the story that we're getting with the Khon Ma and with Tantalos, and they're the conduit for him to be able to get what he needs to try and blow up the wormhole. And so, which again, these are the type of characters that Star Trek has already established. So why create new characters when you already have them? And I think, you know, it's one of the things to which we talked about and we talk about with Enterprise, right? It's like when they stopped just kind of creating new alien races and just start using the ones that were already in existence that made sense for them to be running into in the first place, you know, that's great. That's what needs to happen. And so, I enjoyed having them here, and they don't detract from the rest of the story. They're just here to be a part of the plot and are integral to that. So it's well done writing again.
Yeah. And I think that they helped Garrick's character as well, helped us understand Garrick's character, because Garrick isn't scared of them. No matter how they try to act as Klingons, you can tell that Garrick has a lot of experience dealing with people who others might find threatening, and he's not only not going to back down from it, but he's actually going to manipulate them. And I thought that told us a lot about who Garrick is through Lursa and Bator being there as well. And also, we talked about how DS9 setting itself apart right from the beginning. Just the exchange when they arrive on the station and Bator asks Odo, who are you? When he tells them that they can't have their weapons, and Odo says, I'm the one giving you the choice. And then they hand over the weapons and Odo says, welcome to DS9. And that welcome to DS9 felt to me as a viewer like, welcome to this show. It's going to be a little bit different than what you've seen before. So I liked that.
I never heard that phrase sound so much like an FU.
Yeah, right.
DS9.
Odo's good at delivering things that way.
Yes, he is.
He's quite good, you know. He's not good at pretense, but he is good at making friendly greetings sound like FU. For sure. While we're talking about Lursa and Beator, I did want to mention that Barbara March, who portrayed Lursa, is one of the actors who we've lost in recent years. She passed away in 2019 in August from cancer. She was only 65 years old. And Gwyneth March, who plays Beator, is 66 now. She's still alive and well, but it's Barbara's one of those actors among the many that we are starting to lose from DS9 and Star Trek as a whole.
Yeah, which, you know, it is sad, you know, and it's one of the beauties of having these shows is that they are immortalized forever. And just, you know, Lursa and Beator just some very memorable roles from TNG and, you know, Deep Space Nine. So,
speaking of memorable roles, I just wanted to ask you, because again, especially after we have been spending so much time talking about Enterprise on Warp 5, when Gul Dinar comes on the screen, do you immediately sense Fawn Armstrong in him? Because this time it just popped out to me immediately, whereas the first time this aired, he had only appeared in Star Trek on TNG in one role, the Klingon Captain Chorus in Heart of Glory and Shades of Grey. So I didn't think much about it, but he's portrayed so many characters in Star Trek now over the years. You know, he's kind of like Jeffrey Combs in that sense. And here, when Gul Dinar starts speaking immediately, I'm like, Admiral Forrest is in the house.
Yep. I thought the exact same thing. And, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, Star Trek does so well. And in a lot of ways, it feels like you get a lot of directors who kind of fall in love with certain actors, and they're in quite a few of their films. Chris Nolan does that. Obviously, Steven Spielberg has worked with a lot of the same people. Martin Scorsese has done it as well. They have these actors that they just go to. And, you know, Star Trek has these actors that they go to because they know they do great work and they can play a variety of different roles. And I thought, you know, Fawn Armstrong was great in this episode, really pulled off this character. And so, I actually love when those things happen. But like you said, at this point in time, 100%. No, I'm like, oh, hey, it's Admiral Forrest.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Well, let's wrap up our discussion here of Past Prologue. Do you have any final thoughts? And what's your rating on this one?
You know, I thought that this is a really smart, well-done episode. It also helps reinforce a lot of what they did in the first episode. The fact that they're going to attempt to collapse the wormhole helps reinforce the importance of just this find and what it's going to mean to Bajor and the entire sector of space that we're in. And so this, I mean, we've been in depth with this episode, and I think that's phenomenal. Rewatching this episode, I was just struck by how utterly good this episode is, and it doesn't deserve to be, really, you know, when you're coming off a big pilot to really nail, I think, the second episode. But I'd give this a good 4.5 out of 5 awkward meetings with Garrick, because it really, there's very few things it could even be a 5, really. It's just a great episode, and part of that is just because it so adequately and wonderfully builds on everything that the first episode did.
Yeah, well said, well said. Yeah, those are my thoughts as well. It's an episode that you wouldn't expect to be especially strong, and if you haven't watched it in a long time, your memory of it may not be that it's such a standout episode. But when you really sit down and watch it and you look at what it does for establishing the story, how richly it delves into characters right off the bat, gives us so much background to many of the characters, and effectively ties in to TNG, as we just discussed, in a way that felt natural and made sense, and I think did help to give the show a little bit of a boost. I think it's a really strong episode, so I'm going to give it 8 Bolitrium explosives.
Nice.
Well, everyone, we would love to hear your thoughts on Past Prologue as well. There are many ways for you to share those with us. Perhaps the best way is to go to Facebook and join the Babel Conference. That is our listeners group. Just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field, and it should come right up. If not, type the whole name, the Babel Conference. It is a closed group just for listeners, so if you're joining for the first time, please answer the questions and agree to the rules of the forum so that I can let you in. The purpose of the group is to extend the conversations beyond the podcasts, so we like to keep it just for our listeners rather than just another random Facebook Star Trek group. And you can also send us email if you'd like. Go to our website, trek.fm/contact. Use the form you find there. Choose to send to a show and choose the orb, and that'll come to Matthew and me by email. And of course, you can find us in social media. Our username everywhere is TrekFM. Now, Matthew, when you're not figuring out just exactly which suit you want to buy from Garrick, where can people find you?
Well, Chris, you have no idea how long it takes, but when I'm not doing that, maybe you'll find me posting about it on social media under the name MattRushing02. I'm on Twitter, Instagram, Letterboxd, Vero. You can also find me here on the network doing a bunch of other shows. One is the 602 Club, which is our whole other side of the network that's not devoted to Star Trek. It's devoted to all of the other fandoms we love, so we hope you'll check that out. Doing literary treks as well, talking about the books and the comics of Star Trek. Chris, we've talked about a few times here. We do Warp 5, talking about Star Trek Enterprise. We've got Saddle Up about Strange New Worlds. And we both can't wait for Star Trek Picard Season 3 to come out. And you'll want to check out all those episodes on The Artificial Tango. And then I'm over on the Nerd Party Network as well. I've got a couple of shows there. One is a completed show. Talked about Harry Potter with Drea Kaufman. We did every single chapter, one episode at a time, of that series. And then last but not least, the great John Mills and I talk about Star Wars each and every week over on Aggressive Negotiations. But Chris, when you're not trying to figure out just exactly what you're going to order at the Replimat to go with your tea, where can people find you?
Yeah, that is also a hard choice, because when you can have literally anything, it just kind of makes you freeze up.
It's tough. It's tough.
It's like trying to choose something off Netflix. But anyway, when I'm not doing that, you can find me, as you mentioned, doing all those shows with you here on the network. Also, Larry Nemechek and I do the Ready Room from time to time. And you can find me in many episodes of the back catalog. You can find me in social media. My username is C. Brian Jones, letter C, and Brian with a Y. I'd love to chat with you there about Star Trek or college football or Office Space or news radio or whatever you want to talk about. And again, that is my username everywhere. Twitter's where I'm most active, but you can find me all over the place. If you would like to help us keep all these episodes going, we could definitely use your help to support the network. Just visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm to find out how you can become an associate producer of this show, actually, and help us get through the 30th anniversary rewatch. We would love to have your support there. And I want to send a huge thank you to everyone who is supporting us right now. Well, Matthew, I am looking forward to next time when we're going to be talking about A Man Alone.
Well, Chris, I can't wait to get to that episode, but thank you everyone for joining us, and we will see you next time as we gaze into the orb.